Michelangelo is reported to have said, "The greatest danger for most of us is not that our aim is too high and we miss it, but that it is too low and we reach it." This isn't a Mindset 101 podcast, so I don't have to tell you to aim high, to ride the edge of your capacity. You already know that fortune favors the bold. Think of your grandest goals in your career, in business, in your creative or artistic expression, and with your family. It's my contention that whatever you endeavor to do in life, you're not honoring those goals sufficiently if you do not regularly challenge your body. For our minds rot when our bodies go unchallenged. Today, I interview a man who has taken that to the extreme and arrived at a surprising mindset takeaway, which we'll share at the end of this podcast. Jeffrey Wiest is an Ironman, triathlete, and ultra marathoner, pushing through grueling 20-hour night races at 63 years old. And in his free time, he's an attorney and an author. And he sent me his new book, Racing Against Time, on Ironman, ultramarathons, and the quest for transformation in midlife. I'm Jonathan with Limitless Podcast. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
So I got to tell you right up front, this book did not persuade me to try endurance racing. And I don't think we're going to really try to convince anyone here on this podcast to sign up for a marathon or an Ironman. But I got something invaluable out of this book. It inspired me to endure the challenges I face as a brand new dad. In the mornings when I would read it before feeding my son, I would, you kind of wake up and you're a little bit groggy. And especially as a brand new dad, you're like, oh my gosh, there's so much stuff to do. How am I going to handle everything? But I'd read a chapter or two of this because it's got pretty short, easy to read chapters. And then I'd say, okay, you know what? The challenges I'm facing here are really not that bad. Don't be such a wimp, Jonathan. So I really do appreciate you sending this all the way over to Bulgaria for me to be edified by.
Thank you so much. It really was my pleasure to do that. And we'll get to it later, but I can assure you and to everybody listening, it's not my goal to persuade people to become runners, marathoners, ultramarathoners, triathletes. It is my goal to try to persuade people to really take a serious approach toward extending their health span. But how each individual does that is very much depending on what people like, what gets them excited, what makes them happy. And it's not by any means one size fits all.
So I didn't know much about endurance racing before I had read this. Let's see, once upon a time in a sales job, I had this mentor who was this obscenely charming Brazilian guy, and he had run marathons. And so he told me a little bit about it. But what was interesting to me, what I got from the book is that the focus is not on winning, but on finishing. And I think that's an important mindset shift for life. Is that the marathoner's ethos that I picked up there?
I think it depends on the person. I think, you know, for an elite athlete, obviously for them, how they place in a race is very, very important. I think for better runners, they may truly want to compare themselves to other folks, you know, their same age. I think for people like me who are not particularly fast, it's probably my very first one really was just about finishing. I think after that, I did always have some type of time goal in mind, although I view myself as my competition. And I'm trying to improve myself. I'm trying to satisfy myself. I'm not trying to beat the person next to me.
Yeah, I think that's a good mindset takeaway from the book, because a myopic focus on winning or comparison to others, and in this book, there's very, very little ink spilled on comparison to others. The focus on winning can feed or deflate the ego, while finishing fortifies character. Finishing, being able to stamp done on something, builds trust in yourself. It builds the trust in yourself that one is really going to need when this entropic universe throws you a haymaker, which inevitably it will. Those you got those black swans just out there in the future somewhere coming for you. And about winning, if you're a man and you like that testosterone boost from winning that comes when you beat other men, well, you can boost your testosterone by shining red light on your balls or managing your stress better or eating a great organic steak or having some tantric sex. And I think that focusing in general, kind of generalizing here, focusing on finishing instead of winning often will make you a better person.
I think too, I like the point that you made earlier, kind of extrapolating from a fitness story about how that should affect your mindset when it comes to the very challenging task of taking care of a young baby early in the morning. And to me, I've always been a believer in this notion that sports are a metaphor for life. And I think we get from sports, particularly challenging ones, all sorts of life lessons. And I think facing the difficult challenge, persevering, even when it's tough, even when it's unpleasant, perhaps maybe a little bit painful, and pursuing it to completion, that is a great life lesson to receive. That can be something that you apply to, to your work life, to your personal life, to sustaining your relationship, to being a good parent over a long period of time. So, I think for me, I always have looked at sports as a vehicle for building myself, not just in the realm of sports, but for other spheres in my life.
Give us a summary of your, is it 13 or 14 years now doing endurance racing? Yeah, give us a summary along with how you got into it and how you got, whenever people start a new thing, especially if it's a great feat of endurance, there's that initial challenge period where it just seems monumental. So tell us a little bit about your career, if you call it a career, doing this, and then how you got over that initial hump.
Definitely. So when I was 48, I had been a pretty serious tennis player when I was much younger through college. Then I turned to powerlifting for a few years. And then after I got married, started to have kids, continued to lift weights sporadically, not with real consistency or intensity. Never did anything for my cardiovascular health. And then when I turned 48, you know, kind of realized that I needed to get more serious about things if I wanted to age in the way that I would really like to age and to continue to be active and vital and kind of in the game of life and in a really involved way for as long as possible. So decided to do a 10K. And at the beginning, that was my sole kind of running ambition, was to run a 10K. I had tried one when I was 17, ran 4 miles, walked the final two, and that had always bothered me. So really just wanted to run a complete 10K, took a running class of all things, and was able to do that. And at the time, that was as far as I ever intended to go. I once told a friend that I was as likely to walk on the moon as I was to run a marathon. But, you know, doing one, it kind of sparked something for me. I decided to try to do a few more and turn in a faster time. Wanted to break 1 hour. I was awfully slow in that first one. Then decided to see if I could go longer, did a half marathon, maybe even longer, did a marathon when I was 50. Kept going with that. I was cross training. So the thought, I'll try a triathlon. Started with the shorter distances, sprint, then Olympic. And, you know, over time, just kept climbing that next step, looking for that next mountain. When I was 56, tried my first very serious ultra marathon, a 56-mile race. When I was 57, did my first Ironman and did my second one when I was 59. So, I think for me, you know, looking back, there was a logic to it, just step by step, you know, constantly looking for ways to push myself to do something even harder, and always delighted kind of in the surprise as I did succeed at various steps. And they weren't all successes, but when I did succeed, it was neat to realize that I could do things that I had once thought were outside of my reach.
And reading the book, I was struck by two challenges. The tremendous internal mental struggle when you're 6 hours into a race and your mind just starts inventing all these really good reasons to give up. And then the second challenge was the myriad details, the myriad logistical details that are involved with this. I guess I kind of thought that you just kind of hit the road and headed in the direction of the finish line, but it's really a significant like stack of logistical and planning details that you need to keep track of as your mind is becoming as exhausted as your body.
It's funny that you say that. I think some runners and some running coaches feed that notion that this is really simple stuff, that all you have to do is buy a pair of running shoes, lace them up, and head out the door. And that might be true for very short distances. But as you get into more serious races, there are a lot of logistical challenges, which I have found that I really enjoy. It's fun to plan. It's fun to visualize the upcoming race. And of course, before you actually set foot out there, it all seems like it's going to be fun and exciting, and you know, you're going to finish and you're going to achieve your ambition, and you're going to get a medal and it's going to be great. And then when you get out there, the mental struggles begin. And, you know, again, to me, I think it's another way in which we can grow in all spheres of our life, because it's tough to face down those mental challenges. It's tough not to look too far ahead and realize how much more ground you need to cover before you finish, especially if you're hurting. But if you can manage to do those things, the feeling at the end can be quite extraordinary.
And do you experience pretty sublime flow states when you are out running or in a triathlete event?
You know, honestly, I don't. And I'm a big fan of the whole concept of flow. And there are things that I do. Writing, often I experience flow, but running, I really don't. Having said that, every single time that I finish a workout, every day, 6 days a week, for the last 15 years, every single one, I feel great at the end of a workout. I feel a sense of accomplishment, a feeling of well-being that carries forward to the next few hours of my day. So I love it. I think it's great, but it's not like time stands still. I've lost track of time. in a hypnotic state. I'm just enjoying myself, facing the challenges. I actually don't feel that. And maybe that there are people who do, but that has not been my experience, unfortunately.
Aha. I heard a evolutionary psychologist one time describe why endurance racing can be conducive for some people to reaching really beautiful flow states. And it's because endurance was something that we had to, especially as men, for hundreds of thousands of years, we had to like chase antelopes across the prairie for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours until one of them got tired enough that they could kill it, right? And so that amount of running for a lot of people, I understand, yeah, hooks into this really deep primal state of focus and that classical flow state. Yeah, maybe in the next life you'll do endurance racing again, and you'll have the neurobiology where that awards it. But yeah, writing is the other major thing that stimulates flow state for me as well. So Limitless is a biohacking show, and I assume that you had a real stack of biohacks that you would use to accomplish the insane things that you have.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, definitely, you know, I think right from the beginning, I was doing a lot of reading, a lot of experimenting, trying to find the best ways that I could come up with to really improve. So obviously the most important initial one was to commit myself in a very specific way to fitness, to training 6 days a week at a minimum, not a minimum of days, but 6 days a week, a minimum of 45 minutes each day. Making sure that two of my sessions included weight training, because of course we lose muscle mass as we get older, lose some bone density as we age. So that was hugely important to me. Over time, got more serious about my nutrition, and that really had a huge difference in a lot of different areas of my life. Got more serious about my sleep. And I think all of those things contributed not just to me being a better physical performer, but I think they improved cognition, improved memory, improved my energy levels, improved my sleep. And I think in the business world helped me keep up with colleagues who typically were decades younger than me, which was a great feeling. So yeah, I think those were the main things. Then got into wearing a tracker, which I've gotten more and more serious about, was doing cold water exposure a bunch, ice baths, was doing those 2 times a week. Experimented a bit with meditation. It didn't quite stick for me. Starting now to get into yoga, but I'm always looking for new ways to tweak, to optimize, to continue to get better. I think that is a great goal for all of us to have, is just to continue to improve as we go.
In the book, you talked about the Garmin watch, and the Garmin watches are, I think they're probably the best HRV devices. I did an interview with one of the top doctors in Norway who led this study group of people using Garmin watches. So I'm curious. Okay, actually, I want to ask you about two things. At one point in the book, you mentioned cardiac drift. What is that?
If you get dehydrated, I can't remember exactly. I'm not doing it justice. I'm probably not fully explaining it, but it causes your heart rate to really increase to make up for the fact that you are dehydrated. I think it's working harder to get your blood through your system. I'm probably botching the explanation, but it's an exercise-induced thing. But I was looking at my Garmin watch. I was wearing a heart rate monitor. This was during my first Ironman, and my heart rate was up around 200, which was way, way, way high for me. It should have been closer to like 160, 165 at that point in the race, and realized that I needed to do something to get it under control. I didn't think I was in, you know, AFib or anything like that. I just
I really was quite dehydrated. I was quite exhausted at that point in the race. And so I made some modifications, made sure I was drinking more water, took in some salt, and changed the run-walk ratio that I was using at that time in the race. And within, you know, 30, 40 minutes, I was able to stabilize myself.
And people do sometimes die during these races, right?
In Ironman, it has happened during the swim. It's rare, but it has happened that people do drown. You're in, you know, dark water starting off in the morning. It's dark outside. And sometimes people, you know, get into distress and they aren't seen as they go under. It has happened. It has happened that people have heart attacks, although it's quite rare. And I didn't really think that I was in that kind of jeopardy. I really did think it was because of the conditions of the race and the condition of my body at that time. And thankfully it did respond the way that I thought that it would if I made the right kinds of changes. But I don't truly view these races as physically dangerous. I think they're just, you know, as much mentally challenging as anything else.
Okay. Yeah. I guess the memento mori, fear of death, we can kind of put that to the side. With
very much so. Very much so.
Did you have any interesting findings with HRV in regards to sleep scores, diet, and ensuing performance?
The one thing that's been most clear to me is drinking alcohol, not long before you go to bed, crushes your HRV. It crushes my HRV. I shouldn't generalize for everybody. I have heard that it does seem to be a generalizable phenomenon, but I think that's the one where I've seen the most impact. I think beyond that, honestly, I'm still trying to unpack the data that I'm getting from from my wearable. My wearable now is I wear the Garmin for all of my fitness activity, but I don't wear the watch all the time. I do wear an Oura ring all the time, and so I'm still trying to, you know, maximize my use and benefit from the data that it's giving me.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. Dr. Torkil said the same thing. He said that alcohol is just the enemy of HRV.
Yeah, it's insane. The effects that I've seen are just mind blowing. And so what I've tried to do is, I don't feel like I can entirely exclude alcohol from my life, but I try hard to minimize my drinking. And one way that I've done that is just to commit myself to not drinking by myself. So if I'm home alone, there's no reason to have a drink, and to really reserve it for social settings. And even then, of course, to try not to overdo things, because it does seem to have quite a powerful impact. It's if you really start to pay attention to it, it's pretty shocking.
That's why you should drink the good stuff and drink it with really good people. If you are going to drink, make it worth it.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. And which, look, and the social piece is important to our well-being as well. You know, the goal shouldn't be to go move into a cave somewhere and to spend all of your energy and focus on optimizing your physical health without paying any attention to to your social well-being and to your relationships and your connections with other people. And I think, you know, for a lot of us in the West, you know, some amount of alcohol is part of that process.
Okay. Here's a wildly personal question. Feel free to pass on it. Did you do some like semen retention things? Did you plan ejaculations around racing at all?
Not at all. No. And I never noticed any relationship at all between that and my athletic performance. It could be that if I was a world-class athlete and was competing at a razor's edge, you know, who knows what might actually make that, you know, fraction of a percent of difference that could be, you know, the difference between a gold medal and a bronze, or a bronze and a fourth place finish. But for guys like me, it's just not so crucial to fine tune things to that extent.
Okay. I've read a couple of Tantra books, and they talk about elite performers and how they will make sure that they have like a buffer of at least a couple of days in between. Men will make sure they have at least a couple of days in between an ejaculation and some kind of elite performance. And there's a lot of elite athletes that kind of swear, but they kind of swear by this. And I've adopted that personally, that if I have like some important thing going on in life, I'll try to give myself like 4 or 5 days before that event. I think it lends a little bit of an edge.
And it's funny, in the professional baseball world, there used to be, you know, managers used to tell their players, no sex the night before a game because it weakens the legs. And then there was another coach who said, it's not the sex that weakens the legs. It's running around all over town trying to get sex. That's right. Like, so I don't know that there's a consensus on the link between those things. But, you know, again, look, if I was an elite athlete, I would turn over every stone that I possibly could to try to gain whatever edge I could to narrow the gap between me and the folks ahead of me.
In the book, you talk about the harrowing challenge of cold water immersion in the Ironmans. And as soon as I read that the first time that happened to you, I said, this guy needs to do cold showers. And then you started doing those. And that helped, right?
It did. Absolutely. It made all the difference in the world because I did the exact same race 2 years later, same water, same temperature, same time of day. And it couldn't have gone better. So yeah, I think, you know, the Wim Hof stuff is quite powerful. I got more deeply into it after those races, after the events in the book. But I think there's a lot there. And certainly it was something that I needed because the cold water was like, that was the most frightening thing for me after that first race about taking on a second Ironman.
Yeah. And I'll give you another biohack for cold shock. There's a nootropic, a smart drug that's kind of underground. It's called phenylparacetam, and it's demonstrated in a couple of human clinical trials to make one. Phenylparacetam is from Russia, I believe, and it's demonstrated to make one a whole lot more resilient to cold shock therapy. And phenylparacetam is based on piracetam, which is a very studied and safe and effective smart drug. As far as drugs and pharmaceuticals go, this is like a really low risk category. So I'll link up to phenylparacetam in the show notes for this, just in case people need an extra cold shock therapy hack.
I love that. I think, you know, it's funny. There was one that I never did get around to trying, but it made sense to me, which was you fill like a big bowl with ice water and plunge your face into it. Because you have like a major nerve, could be the trigeminal nerve in your face, which I think is part of why some folks like me experience cold shock, because you're getting that cold water in the face and it's like immediately, you know, kind of, you know, it's getting spread all over the face and it really can have a powerful effect. And you can apparently desensitize yourself by, you know, doing these regular immersions of your face in the bowl of water. And I have to say, what I have found with the ice baths is when I first started doing them, you know, I would breathe through the entire 2 minute period that I was then doing. And more recently, I'll do it for 3 minutes and my breathing is completely regular breathing. It's not heavy inhales, heavy exhales. I'm just sitting there calmly, you know, listening to a song, waiting for the time to pass and then jumping out of there. So there's no question, just from my own experience, for me at least, that you know, that it does build up a tolerance and a resilience against the effects of cold exposure.
And you have a couple of mantras that you use during these types of moments in the races?
I did for the my longest running race was a 72-mile race called the Midnight Express around Lake Tahoe between Nevada and California. And my coach gave me a mantra, which was to remind myself at various points, at low points during the race, I'm fit, I'm strong, I can keep going. And I did actually use it, and it did actually help because I did reach quite a low point. In fact, at one point in that race, I was having tremendous left knee pain and actually decided to quit. But, you know, then decided to procrastinate with respect to quitting, that there was no rush to quit, and to see if I could experiment a little bit and stabilize my knee, which ultimately I was able to do and to stay out there. So, yeah, I think the mantra can be quite helpful. And there are other folks who do something similar.
And you had another, this could also be a good mantra from the book, pain is temporary, victory is forever.
Yeah, I love that one. If at marathons, you do see all sorts of great signs along the course. Some are funny, some are inspirational. And that was one that I see at a lot of marathons, at a lot of races. And I specifically thought of that one when the knee was hurting me, that, you know what, it hurts, but if I can somehow stay out here, if I could push through this and finish this race, I will have something I can cherish the rest of my life. And it's 2 years later, and I probably think about that race multiple times every single week. I really do cherish it. And so I was happy that I listened to the sign.
Yeah. 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 That's one of those things that should probably be like posted up in the office.
Yep. Very much so. It's a good reminder to think in that sense, to think, well, you know, obviously sometimes you want to think short term and not get intimidated by what's still to come. But there are also times when I think you want to imagine how you will feel about a particular accomplishment looking back down the road. And in that sense, I think that can be a powerful tool.
Okay, let's talk about diet some. You mentioned in the book that you were a vegan, but that changed. Why?
I did start to get concerned about my protein intake, especially as I'm getting older now. And so decided to keep the main features of my veganism, no meat, no chicken, no dairy, but to add fish back into my diet. And it seems to have been a successful experiment to do that. I'm probably about 4-5 or so years into that. So I was a strict vegan from about 2013 to about 2021 or so, and then brought fish back. And it's given my diet more variety, honestly. And definitely, I'm getting a lot more protein more effectively, more efficiently. And I think for me, it's been good. And I find that fish doesn't cause me the kind of heartburn and just gastric challenge that like heavy doses of red meat used to cause me. I used to love the taste, but I used to feel like, for me, and again, everybody's different, but I felt like my body was still digesting the meat hours after the meal. And I don't get that feeling with fish, and certainly not with vegetables.
Do you meet many endurance athletes that are vegans?
Yeah, I think you're not going to meet almost any world-class endurance athletes who are vegans. But, you know, among folks like me, you know, age groupers, you know, people who just are competing in their particular age group and not necessarily leading the pack, I think it's not that uncommon to find people who are super focused on their health, on their well-being, and they're looking to optimize everything, including nutrition, and have latched onto a vegan diet as being their best bet. And honestly, with veganism, as with, you know, Ironmans and marathons, I don't seek to be an evangelist that everybody should be on that particular diet. I think we're all a little bit different when it comes to food, and we have to find the approach that works best for our particular system.
One diet hack that you had in the book that I think probably does generalize to everyone is, quote, I had read that one key to achieving a desired weight was to slow down the pace of one's eating. Eating too fast, which growing up in a big family had always seemed like a necessity, caused you to continue to eat even after you were full and before your brain received the message that you had eaten enough. That made sense to me. But how do you slow down your eating? Finally, one day it hit me. I needed to concentrate on taking a single bite at a time and then fully chewing and then swallowing that entire bite before taking another one. Taking a sip of water between bites would further slow the process down. As someone who tended to wolf down food, I had subconsciously been shoveling in additional forkfuls before I had finished what was already in my mouth. Yeah, that's a good habit. A lot of us do get in that habit of eating way too fast, and then we're not properly digesting. What is it they say that you should chew? Like if you're having something like meat, you should chew it like 40 to 50 times before swallowing.
Yeah, I think to me that I do think there are some generalizable things. Like, I think nobody who's serious about nutrition would argue that you should wolf your food. I think no one who's serious about nutrition would argue that you should be eating lots of processed sugar or drinking soda or other soft drinks that are high in calories. I think, you know, there are some basic things that I think we can, you know, we probably can all agree on. You shouldn't be overeating, you know, however you define, you know, what's the appropriate amount of food to be taking in. You shouldn't be eating more than that for you, for your body type and all the rest. But I think that the different pathways of getting there, whether it's paleo or veganism or intermittent fasting, you know, there are people who will swear by individual ones. And I think there's good science, you know, behind a lot of them. But I just also think it's so individual, and you got to find something that you will commit to, stick to, integrate as a habit, and not agonize or struggle with it every single day, because that's not sustainable.
You've widely read books about health, longevity, anti-aging, and what you've accomplished is great evidence of the truth and the value in that. Have there been any surprises for you where you tried some health thing, maybe a supplement or a new modality, and it had really surprising effects?
That's a great question. That's a really great question. I think to this point, I wouldn't necessarily say that. What I guess I would say is some things have been much easier for me to integrate than others. And flexibility, yoga, to me, is a huge example of unfinished business for me. I know that I'm way too inflexible. I know that a program like yoga will improve my flexibility. And in the last 2 months, I've gotten pretty strict finally about doing yoga at least once a week. And in the next couple of weeks, I plan to increase it to twice a week. But that one has been an ongoing struggle for me. And I'm frustrated by that, because I really do feel like it's something that I need to get more serious about, because I do think it's holding me back to some extent. But other things, you know, so many other things have gone quite smoothly. Changing my diet to veganism was really just a month of struggle, and then it was smooth sailing. You know, integrating different sports has been pretty straightforward, but the flexibility has been my big challenge.
Yeah, well, yoga will get you there with persistence. Maybe you'll one day end up doing like acro yoga. Have you seen that?
I have not. I think Tim Ferriss is a huge proponent of it, and sounds great. And I actually should look into it, because I am a big believer to keep experimenting until you find something that works. And honestly, that would be advice I would give to just anybody when it comes to fitness. You know, try particular activities, and you may need to try them a few times to really make sure you're giving them a fair shake. But keep doing that until you find ones that you can commit yourself to and turn into a habit, and not fight yourself, and not, you know, not have anxiety or annoyance at the prospect of doing them again. And acro yoga could actually be, who knows, that could be the thing that unlocks yoga for me. It's funny, I appreciate your mentioning that, because I had heard of it before, never really looked into it, but now I will. I think that could be interesting.
Yeah, that might be something that you could do with your lady. couples goal. I'll add a video of acro yoga in the show notes for this. Once upon a time, I was in a bar in Panama. I think I was trying to work on my laptop in a bar in Panama, which is not really a recipe for productivity. And these two girls came up to me and they said, "We're going to do acro yoga. Do you want to do acro yoga with us?" I was like, "What's that?" They said, "It's this thing where like we lift you up with our feet." And then, and so I tried it and I was like, okay. That was kind of cool, but maybe that can be your new crazy thing to try.
I love it. I will look into it. It sounds like fun.
Okay. Next, I wanted to ask you about time management. You must have some really good time management strategies for balancing the insane training regimens that you've had while acting as a general counsel at a corporation, being a father, and going through a divorce.
Yeah, I think for me, I think a couple of things. I think one, it honestly ended up helping that I didn't really get serious about endurance sports until my kids were older. I think my youngest child was 19 when I did that first 10K. So I think that, no, that's not right. My youngest child was 13 when I did that first 10K. My oldest was 18. So my kids were in high school or just finishing high school or just about to enter high school. So I think that was good. I think it would have been hard to get into serious endurance sports with young children at home. I don't know that that would have been a responsible thing to do. But then in general, when it comes both to my writing and to my fitness, they're important to me. They're priorities, but I also work for a living. So I'm a huge believer in the kind of personal finance strategy of paying yourself first and applied to these things. It means doing them early in the morning, first thing before my workday starts, because I feel like I typically own and control my morning. I don't own and control my day once the workday starts. And so I might think I'll have time to train right during lunch or after work, but invariably things happen, especially in the startup world where things are fast moving. And I can't count on being able to do personal things after the workday has begun.
So the secret is to go to bed earlier so that you're waking up with the birds.
Yeah, I think when things were most intense at work, I was getting up at 5, and that gave me enough time to write and train and be ready for the start of the workday at about 9. That seemed to be really good. But of course, if you're going to do that, you can't burn the candle at both ends. So that does mean, you know, you really have to be getting to bed, in my case, by 10. And I was awfully tired by the time 10 o'clock rolled around. It wasn't hard to go to sleep then.
Okay, so let's talk about Comrades, which this is like the peak of your adventure in this sport. Tell people about it.
So it's a cool race. It's one that I had read about before. It was started in 1921 by a South African. And he intended it as a living memorial to his comrades who had died during what was then known as the Great War, later known as World War I. And it was intended to be this, you know, really challenging, hard, tough race that would stimulate these kinds of feelings of sacrifice and brotherhood and all of the rest. It's a 56-mile race between two cities, Pietermaritzburg and Durban. And it's a race that reverses course each year, or reverses direction each year. And there's a tremendous amount of climbing and descending from Pietermaritzburg to Durban. There's 7,000 feet of descending and 5,000 feet of climbing. And from Durban to Pietermaritzburg, it's the reverse. You have a strict 12-hour cutoff from when the gun goes off. It's the world's, by the way, largest and oldest ultramarathon. And then there are, I believe, 6 intermediate cutoffs that you have to hit by particular times. Or if you don't, if you miss a cutoff, you're put on a Baylor bus and taken to the big soccer stadium where the race ends. I tried it in 2018 and got cut at the last cutoff before the stadium after 51 miles and 11 hours of running. I missed it by a minute 44.
But it was a fantastic experience for me. You know, it was a race that was really outside of my comfort zone. I thought I probably had at best a 50% chance of succeeding, but I had promised myself that I would run until I either finished successfully or got cut. But no matter how bad I felt, I would not quit. And I kept to that promise. But even more, I recognized that I might not succeed. I wanted to set my next goal so I would have something emotionally to pivot to. And the goal that I set before that race for after the race was to do a half Ironman the following year and a full Ironman the year after that. And those goals I did hit. So to me, in a very direct way, that miss, that failure, led to successes that I'm especially proud of. So I think, you know, in general, I think we shouldn't be afraid of failure. You know, there can be all sorts of growth on the other side of failure. And I love the expression that Jim Murphy of Inner Excellence uses, that failure is feedback. And candidly, the feedback that I got from that race is, you know, I'm not fast enough over very long distances. And that's probably not something that I'm going to be able to truly change in a meaningful way. And that's okay. I just need to focus on races that are more suited to my style of running.
Yeah, you really pushed to the edge of your limits before that self-acceptance.
Yeah, and look, it was good. I think I really do think that most of us just fear failure way too much, and it causes us not to take chances. When I was at the expo for that race, I bought keychains for all four of my kids. And when I got back, I had them close their eyes and put their hands out, and I put a keychain in each hand. And I said, look, here's the deal. Like, I'm so happy I tried that race, even though I didn't make it. And I think, you know, as I look back at my life, the things that I regret the most are not the things that I tried and failed at. They're the things that I didn't try because I, you know, was afraid or anxious or didn't want to put in the work, didn't want to take the chance that I might not succeed. And I do truly believe that, you know, now from the vantage point of 63, when I look back, those are the things I regretted, the things that I just didn't do. But trying and failing, you know, we can't always succeed, and that's okay.
Okay, this seemed kind of insane to me. Before you attempted Comrades the first time, you barely got any sleep.
Yeah, I made up several mistakes in that race that could have actually been the difference between success and failure. But I stayed in Durban where the race ends. I did not stay near where the race started. It was hard to stay near where the race started because it's a huge race, over 20,000 people, and there just aren't that many hotels in Pietermaritzburg. It's not really a tourist destination.
20,000 participants?
Yeah, it's actually the world's largest and oldest ultramarathon. So about 21,000 folks try that race every year. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that must have been like impossible. The ideal locations of hotel rooms were in extreme demand.
Yeah, very much so. And so and the race started, I think, at 6 o'clock in the morning, maybe even earlier than that, maybe five. No, it could have been five. And I had over an hour bus ride to get there. And then they were saying there were going to be some road closures, so you should get on an early bus. So I took a bus at 1:30 in the morning, and I maybe slept an hour at the most before I left on that bus, which, you know, in hindsight, I should have done a bunch of things differently. But, you know, what can you do? I think there's a belief among distance runners that you want to get a good night's sleep the night before your race, recognizing that the last night before your race, often you're too nervous or anxious to really sleep well. And that can be okay. And you can be surprised at how much you can accomplish on a bad night's sleep.
With the advent of all these sleep tracking gadgets, some biohackers could kind of become prima donnas where they get a bad sleep score and then they say to themselves, oh, I got a bad sleep score. I won't do my workout today. But clearly your performance there at Comrades demonstrates that our capacities, even sleep deprived, can surprise us.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think to me, the takeaway is that we can surprise ourselves, that we are capable of a lot more than we think on any given day, even a day in which we did not get a good night's sleep. Having said that, the takeaway should not be that sleep is not important. I do think it's clear that we need to be mindful of our sleep quantity and quality on a regular basis. And if we are doing that, hopefully that gives us the strength and resilience to be able to weather a bad night's sleep and still go out there and turn in a good performance. And in general, I think, to your point, I think these scores can get overly much into our heads and can make us feel negative about ourselves, can make us feel incapable. And I think that is, that can be an unfortunate consequence of tracking our data. And we need to be mindful of that and try not to succumb to that kind of negativity.
Yeah, there's an analysis paralysis trap there, certainly. Let's talk about coaching. You had very good coaching. Let's see, there's a section. This jumped out to me. Quote, Lindsay Perry said, we couldn't look at the IMAS, Ironman, as a success, but there were a lot of good elements. And in the scheme of things, I hadn't done too badly. And I thought that was kind of remarkable because this was an event where you really, really pushed yourself to your limits. And then your coach didn't sing you a sweet song afterwards. He said, we can't look at it as a success. That struck me. The benefit of good coaches is that they will call out a failure, or they will call you out when they know that there's some room for improvement. And that's something that you can only get from a good coach. Your family and your loved ones are just going to say, proud of you for trying anyways. Your therapist is going to probably tell you something similar with a little bit of psychoanalysis, maybe. And if you're a person that thinks that AI can be like your therapist or your coach, well, AI is so sycophantic. It's never going to give you good feedback. But yeah, that struck out to me. Some of the things Lindsay Perry had to tell you.
He's amazing. He's actually the official coach for the Comrades Marathon, which is how I first came across him. And he also is he's been a coach for the South African triathletes at the last three Olympic Games, and has also coached, I think he coached one of the Zimbabwean female marathoners also at the last Olympics. So he's an extraordinary coach. He's an incredibly positive, sympathetic, empathetic person, but very encouraging and very direct. And it's exactly what I need. I want someone who's expert, who's smarter than me, who's, more capable than I am of creating a plan. And it gives me the confidence because some of the stuff seems hard. It's probably not things that I would set out for myself, but I trust him. If he believes I can do it, then I believe I can do it. And it gives me the ability to push myself harder in training. And if you work hard enough in training, you'll have a good, hopefully, performance on race day. So yeah, I love that about him. I love how honest and straightforward he is with me. It's been incredible.
Are you getting any coaching for anything now?
Yeah, I still work with Lindsay. And my plan, obviously, honestly, is to work with him for as long as I possibly can because I still race. I still want to make sure I'm properly prepared for my races, that I'm setting sensible targets for myself. And I feel like having a coach like Lindsay takes the thinking out of it for me because I have other things going on in my day. And I love the fact that he's taking the data, he's analyzing it, he's giving me a program. And we can talk about it, and we talk once a week. But in general, he calls the shots, and honestly, I love it.
And what's ahead for you? Or I want to hear what's ahead for you. And then also a little bit about the Berlin Marathon.
So basically, I talk a little bit about this at the end of the book. My goal for the next few years has been to run the original six world major marathons, Tokyo, London, Berlin, Chicago, New York, Boston. And if you finish all six, you get a six-star finisher's medal. And there are a bunch of folks around the world who are chasing after this. A bunch of folks have already accomplished it. It's not, you know, it's not something that, you know, is novel. And so for me, I like the idea of having a long-term goal, something that will take years that I could work toward. I like long-term goals. I think they're fun. I think they give me a sense that my life has adventure, that I'm on a journey, on a quest, as it were. And it's a lot of fun. So I did my first one in 2024 in Tokyo, 2025 in April, I did London, and then most recently did Berlin. Berlin, candidly, was a brutal experience for me. It was, you know, the one thing you can't control on race day is the weather. And it was a brutally hot day. It was about, by the time my wave started, it was about 77 degrees, no clouds in the sky. Reached 80 an hour or two later. And, you know, those are hot, and it was humid as well. Those are tough conditions to run in. So it ended up being my slowest marathon ever. But, you know, I did finish the race, got my medal, and I'm now halfway to that goal of completing all six. And I'll do number four, probably either Chicago or New York next fall is my current plan. Then do the other one of those two the following fall, and then do Boston probably the following April. And that's my kind of current thinking. And then, you know, I may do some shorter stuff this current year just to work on my speed and really to try to focus, you know, more on this flexibility challenge of mine and really to try to take that seriously. So I think for the next 12 months or so, I'm going to stay away from marathons and longer races and really just focus on, you know, kind of healing my body. In the last 8 months, I've run two marathons and one 50-kilometer race. And I think I need to take a few months away from the really serious distance.
And the book talks a lot about injuries. And this is one thing that served to dissuade me from getting into this sport. Are you, have you employed some injury recovery modalities? Are you doing things with lasers, red light, stem cells?
Doing things with, I work now with a physical therapist, and actually I go to him prophylactically about once every 5 weeks or so, just to make sure that my body is staying, you know, the way functioning the way that should be. And he's a big believer in dry needling. So I've been through tons and tons of dry needling treatments, and I went through some of those along over the years in rehabbing particular injuries. I had a persistent case of plantar fasciitis, and the dry needling helped there. I had a calf injury years ago. The dry needling helped with that. So I have found dry needling to be tremendous. I think they use also some stim, but I haven't used any. I haven't done any of those on my own. I've done them working with the physical therapist. But I think there are a lot of things there that can be done that can be quite helpful, in addition to the usual things of, you know, rehabilitation exercises of various kinds, which are also important.
Mm. If there's still some people listening to this saying, why the hell would you spend your time doing this? You wrote in the book, I wanted to live a life that would impress and inspire me, whether the 17-year-old me who would be amazed to learn what was still in store as I got much older, and let's face it, to a 17-year-old, 60 is old, or to the end of life me, looking back on a life lived greatly with few regrets.
Yeah, I do think that way. I honestly do. And I think to me, the injuries are a cost of doing business to an extent, although I think you can minimize those costs if you really do get good at listening to your body, recognizing when an injury might be developing and backing off or making some changes. But if you do get hurt, You know, work with a good orthopedic doctor or with a good physical therapist, do what they tell you to do. And, you know, with surprising speed, you can usually get back on track. But I think, you know, and again, don't get me wrong. And there are people who do this. I don't think you should be running yourself truly into the ground. You know, for me personally, I want to be doing this stuff into my 80s. And if I'm going to be able to do that, I do need to be mindful about my body and not be cavalier about hurting it. And so I want to minimize the injuries that I might get if I do actually fail to head run off and get one. I want to work with the right folks, do the right exercises, the right treatments, and then, you know, reintegrate myself into training. I think the injuries for most of us can be quite manageable.
Okay. In the book, you quoted David Goggins, who wrote, "Your willingness to succeed builds self-esteem. It broadens your concept of your own capability. Yet it is the first thing we lose touch with when things go bad. After that, giving up often feels like the sanest option. And maybe it is, but know that quitting chips away at your self-worth and always requires some level of mental rehab. A successful mission seldom requires any emotional maintenance." I wasn't sure what to make of that. What do you make of that?
Well, what I make of it is, I thought about it because it was a particular half Ironman race that I was struggling in, and realized that I was doing so badly in the race that just finishing by the cutoff was in question. And, you know, I could have just dropped out of the race. But you know, I really thought of that quote, and basically, even if it was going to be a sloppy performance and a bad time that would embarrass me, if I could pull myself together, tough it out, finish by the cutoff, which I was able to do, I would feel good about myself and about my ability to dig deep during a difficult time. And that truly is how I felt after the race. I think if I had quit, it would have caused me problems. And I think for me, so much of endurance sports is about mental strength, mental toughness, building it, nurturing it, sustaining it, and not doing things that might weaken it or undercut it. And so that's one of the things I love about Goggins. I think a lot of folks love him just because he's just an incredibly accomplished endurance athlete. He's tough, he's strong, he's inspiring. But I actually think if you read his two books, you'll see there's a lot of emotional intelligence in there, a lot of great thinking about how to use sport to really enhance every aspect of your life, including your mental approach to all the things that are important to you.
Mm. And I imagine part of the motivation has to be the pursuit of natural beauty. In modernity, we are all kind of drowning in this digital deluge of overstimulation. But with these, you were describing the Midnight Express, where you're dodging drunk drivers and bears out there in Tahoe. And yeah, I was just imagining looking up at the night sky, and that experience of the beauty of nature has to be one of the major motivating factors to keep doing these.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's funny. I've had a couple experiences like that one, running in the middle of the night and looking up at, there's very little light pollution there. The sky was spectacular. And I realized certainly as I was doing it, that this is an unusual experience that most of us don't get to experience. And there was another, my first 50 kilometer, 31 mile race was around a lake in Delaware. And it started in the early morning. And I remember, you know, running around this lake and watching the sun come up over the lake. You know, it was a peaceful forest. It was just, the setting couldn't have been more beautiful. And again, it was the same kind of thing, like, wow, this is a great experience to have. And not many of us will get to have an experience like this. So I think, you know, if you do enough of these kinds of races, you'll have all sorts of special moments, some of which really do involve the beauty of nature, the beauty of great cities, you know, the spirit of crowds and just excitement and being in a positive environment, but there's just a lot to recommend it that you know, goes way beyond just the pure athletics of it all.
Do you think you're going to do more night races?
That's a good question. I did a 50-mile race 2 days before my 62nd birthday. So after the book, and in some ways it has become my favorite race. So I do like the idea of doing another super long race. And at night, the night part really was cool. I don't know. I'll have to see, you know, what sort of is available, what works with my schedule, what works with my travel. But yeah, I do think I'm not done with the very long stuff. And whether it involves a night component or not, there is something special. They really are. Those races are like life in a day with, you know, ups and downs and optimism and pessimism and kind of all of the rest. And it's quite something.
Okay, I got a philosophical musing to inspire you to do another night race. I had some thoughts on viewing the Milky Way, and I actually wrote these in a novel that I wrote called Hourglass. This is what I wrote. Beholding the cosmos, every man or woman is struck by their divine majesty and enormity. Yet, we're able to comprehend the universe and at least theorize about its mysteries. Thus, the awesome majesty of the universe twinkling above, demanding our curiosity, is a mirror of the universe within us all. It reminds us that the glory of the human mind is unequaled in all creation and contains some spark of the divine.
I love that. I love that. That's powerful.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah.
And I love that. And a biohack. When you do another night race, I would suggest Scissandra. Scissandra is a adaptogenic herb, and it improves night vision. It's one of the best natural solutions for improving night vision so that you can dodge those bears.
Thankfully, they warned us about the bears. Thankfully, none of them showed up. But they did make me a bit nervous. But in the end, they were not a factor.
Have you ever hallucinated in the middle of a race?
I have not. I've read certainly about people doing it, especially in even longer races, 100 miles and longer. I do read about that all the time. But for me, I've always felt like I'm in control of my faculties, you know, in the Ironmans and the different ultras. Doesn't mean that I'm not tired. Doesn't mean that I'm not negative, that I'm not, you know, that I don't get down at myself on myself at certain times. But there's never been hallucinations, never been a sense that I'm out of control. I've lost control. I don't know where I am or what I'm doing. I've never reached that point of, you know, kind of, I guess, extreme collapse of some kind. That's never happened to me, thankfully.
Okay. Yeah. I'm imagining some pretty creepy hallucinations that you could have out there. Tahoe, you'll run into Bigfoot or something like that, but it'll just be a hallucination. This could be a good horror movie, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. But although the night part of that race was the start of the race. Race started at 9 o'clock at night. So, you know, actually ran the night portion when I was my most energetic. And it was after a summer of training and hot, humid conditions. So I really loved the night part because the night sky was magnificent and it was cool and refreshing. And I wasn't getting crushed by the sun or hot temperatures. So that race actually became a lot more challenging when the sun came up.
As I was reading this book, for some reason, I kept thinking about another podcaster that I know who has recently done a 49-day dark retreat where he just goes in a pitch black room at a retreat, I think in like Peru or someplace like that. And he just hangs out alone in the dark for months. And he describes this as the most mentally tortuous endurance feat, just spending months wrestling with the darkest recesses of your mind. And this is even more unappealing to me than endurance racing. There's for the ambitious, avaricious person into personal development or athletic endeavor, it can be pushed like too far. And I think you've done this the right way. Although you wrote towards the end of the book, lots of folks like me who devote a ton of time to sport try to justify it on the ground that they are inspiring others in their lives to reach higher. I have actually never been a huge fan of that. I think it's a way for those of us who take so much time away from others in our lives to chase after our own dreams to justify our actions. At the end of the day, there is a lot of selfishness involved in chasing things like Iron Man and comrades. But Jeff, I think your motives are pure. I got the distinct impression from your book that you race to inspire your children and your family. And I really think you have.
I appreciate that. I really appreciate that. I like to think that I have, but I also recognize that, you know, my kids are adults and they are charting their own paths in this world. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I think for me, I think we all should live with integrity. We all should live with authenticity. We all should pursue the things that fulfill us. And hopefully that has a positive impact on those around us. And look, I think one way in which this kind of approach to fitness is a good thing for the people in our lives is, you know, we've all, you know, as we get older, where we become acquainted with stories of and maybe in our families, maybe, you know, through friends of, you know, older folks whose health, is in decline, sometimes really prematurely from having led a sedentary life or not having attended to, you know, things like, you know, just good wellness practices throughout their lives. That's a hardship on the people in your life. And so I think if we can take good care of ourselves, which, you know, to my mind involves some significant role for fitness, however you approach that, that is a kindness to the people that matter to you. And reduces the chance that you're going to become a burden to them, a source of stress to them, a caregiving obligation to them. I think those are important things. And hopefully it inspires, but of course, at the end of the day, they're going to have to make, you know, their own choices about what really matters to them, what really moves them.
And you mentioned your brother, and you inspired your brother to complete Comrades.
Yeah, that was wonderful. And that actually, you know, to me was very satisfying because it was an example of this whole inspiration thing kind of working right in front of my eyes. He's 20 years younger than me, came with me when I tried the race a second time. And he finished it and did it in an absolutely extraordinary way and really tried hard to help me finish. Unfortunately, I'd gotten hurt, so I missed too much training and did actually even worse than I did the first time I tried it. Only made it for 35 miles the second time. But he made it and finished with about 7 minutes to spare. And it was an inspiration to see it. And he was absolutely thrilled to have done it and really treasures the experience. And so that was actually pretty satisfying to me to have played a small role in that.
Yeah, obviously you've got some endurance genes in the family. What do your kids do? Do they have any crazy obsessions like this?
All my kids were involved in sport when they were younger. My two daughters played soccer. My two boys played ice hockey. One of my boys played ice hockey through college. That particular child is actually a really talented runner over shorter distances. he can run a 5K in about 20 minutes, which is pretty amazing. And we'll see. I mean, of course, in my case, I didn't take these things up until I was in my late 40s. So I think they have plenty of time to decide, you know, if this is something that they want to make a part of their lives as well. In my case, I was happy that I did delay it until after my kids had grown a bit. And until after I had sort of more freedom, was more established in my career, it seemed like a responsible time to start devoting myself in a serious way to these kinds of demanding sports.
So here's the mindset takeaway that I got from the book is to aim high, like Michelangelo said. Pick a BHAG, big, hairy, ambitious, big, hairy, audacious goal, but quit while you are ahead. And that's what you did, is you pushed yourself right to the edge of your limits. You availed yourself of the best coaching in the world to extend those limits. And then you knew when to quit. I think that's a really good takeaway, because there's when we get our ego invested in bigger number, bigger metric, then we lose sight of so much other beauty and meaning in life.
Yeah, it's funny. I think the only thing that I might characterize a little bit differently is, I think for me, it's not so much quitting. It's more about, you know, constantly asking myself what my goal should be. And for years, for the first 13 years or so of this journey, the goals always were, how can I push myself farther? How can I challenge myself with something even more difficult? So going from, you know, sprint to Olympic distance, to half Ironman, to full Ironman, with triathlon and with running, you know, going from the shorter distance to the much longer distances. I think now at this point in my life, I'm absolutely still committed to intense fitness. I'm still committed to endurance, but I'm no longer looking to one up myself. I'm no longer looking to, well, I did 72 miles, now it's time for 100, or, you know, I did an Ironman, so now it's time to either do an even harder Ironman or do, you know, some crazy race that's even longer than an Ironman. Like I'm done with that kind of approach, But I'm still passionate, committed, and really in love with being able to participate in these kinds of endurance sports.
Let me ask you, if you could be convinced that there was some miracle mitochondrial supplement that could de-age you by 10 years, 15 years, do you think you would give comrades like another go? If there was hypothetically, if there was a biohack that could turn back the clock like 10 years, do you think you would change your mind on that?
It's possible. And look, it does certainly seem to be a strong possible direction of these different interventions with respect to health span and lifespan and human performance. And so, I'll take things as they come, but if it does transpire that there are things like that actually work, that have the right kind of safety profile, and that change up what my potential might be, absolutely, I would revisit my goals. I think for me, I'm trying to be at the same time aspirational and also pragmatic and grounded in reality. And so I'm trying to set audacious goals that are consistent with my reality. And if my reality changes in some fashion, then I think the goals need to change as well.
Okay. So I've given everyone my mindset, TLDR, from the book, which is to take on really big goals that inspire you to push yourself all the way to your limits. But then once you've reached some of those goals, adopt a little bit more holistic view of life. And well, I'd suggest that people pick up this book. If people are interested in endurance racing, it has actually quite a bit of like technical technical kind of advice that I think could help people in it. But I think more broadly, it's a good idea to read a couple of books every year about people that just endured through crazy challenges, as that just puts the challenges that we have in life into perspective. And when you're and that's even a little bit different than watching a movie, although there is that one really good movie. It's called, I think it's just called The Endurance. It's a documentary about the Shackleton expedition to Antarctica. You've watched that one?
I have, and I've read the book. It's the most extraordinary story. Yeah, I second your recommendation. It's absolutely unbelievable.
Okay, I will link to that documentary in the show notes for this one. Yeah, people should sit down. I think it's about 2 hours, but I try to watch that one every couple of years because, yeah, it just reminds me that my life is, in fact, incredibly comfortable and I shouldn't be such a wimp.
I really appreciate, I really appreciate your taking the time to, you know, to read the book and to chat about it. And honestly, part of why I wrote it was exactly for the, you know, for the reason that you've outlined, which is I think we can profit from reading stories about other people's struggles and persistence and challenges and adventures and setbacks, even if it's not something that we ourselves plan on doing precisely. I think we can grow from that. And it's honestly, it's a way to live multiple lives and to, you know, to kind of vicariously experience something that's quite different than perhaps we are in going through in our own lives or intend to go through. So, you know, I think reading about adventures and things of that sort can be quite a great experience.
Well said. That's a good note, I think, to end this one on. So, Jeff, please stick around as I close out here. I'm Jonathan Roseland with Limitless Mindset, looking forward to a continued conversation with you.